The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section, February 8, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, A Wrinkle in the Realm by Ben Oakley. The first time he realized that there was something not quite right about him was when a woman crossed the street as she saw him coming. He thought it was a coincidence. Then it happened again. He began to watch those around him. One day, on the underground, a woman three empty seats away moved her handbag to her other side when she saw him. He wasn't sure why. After the fourth or fifth time something like that happened, he looked at himself in the mirror. He thought he was normal, like everyone else. But when he looked at himself through the eyes of those who clutched their handbags when they saw him, he understood that his face was not as normal as he'd thought. He couldn't see what was wrong with it, but the longer he looked, the more certain he became. Something was wrong with him that he couldn't see. The mirror revealed aspects of his face that he hadn't noticed before. Which aspect made people cross the street to avoid him? This troubled him so much that he was unable to sleep most nights. He wanted to talk to someone about it, but he couldn't think of anyone. When it was daylight, on his way to work, he looked nervously at people. He wondered when they would see him and act on that seeing. But people hurried past without noticing him at all. This was as baffling as when they crossed the street. Why didn't they see him? He was purposefully looking at them to see if they reacted to something strange in his face. But the more he looked, the less they seemed to see him. The experience of being fled from at dusk and not seen in daylight struck him as a paradox. After a while, he decided to test whether it was really him they were fleeing and what it was about him that caused this reaction. He reasoned that from a distance, at dusk, it is difficult to see the details of a person. Therefore, it had to be something about his shape, the way he moved through space, that made people want to avoid him. He concluded that it had to be the way he walked. He experimented with different kinds of walks. He walked in a bandy-legged way. He made himself shorter and less threatening. He walked sideways to be less conspicuous. All this only made people avoid him more. They crossed the street even sooner. One evening, he was going home from the small advertising firm where he worked. He made his way down the street with its double row of plane trees. The trees took up part of the pavement, obliging people to go around them one at a time. He liked the trees on his street. Each one grew at a unique angle. They were the only things in the world that were good to him. They never judged him. When he went past, he always touched them. The trees were big and silent now. He walked slowly. He saw the form of a woman far up the street, and he made himself smaller. Then a man came in from a side street. The man, tall and a little bow-legged, walked toward the woman. What would the woman do? Would she cross the road at the sight of the man? Was it maleness that caused the fear? The man walked past the woman, who hadn't crossed the road. It wasn't maleness, then. He wondered when the woman would notice him. What would she do when she did? At that moment, she looked up and saw him. Her body recoiled noticeably, and she hurried across the road. He was hurt by this. He stopped and couldn't move, rooted in a nameless fury and shame. His mind was full of things he wanted to say to the woman. He wanted to say, "There's nothing wrong with me, you know," or, "I'm not going to mug you," or, "Do you think I am remotely interested in your body?" Or, why did you cross the road when you saw me and not when you saw the man in front of me, who looked much more dangerous? He had many things he wanted to say. The street was empty. It was getting dark. And then he did something that surprised him. He began to cross the street. The woman saw him crossing. A look of alarm appeared on her face. She started to cross back. He followed. She didn't want it to be obvious that she was avoiding him, but she made one last effort not to meet him in the middle of the street. As he drew nearer, she opened her mouth in the beginnings of a scream. Just before he brushed past her, he said, "There's nothing wrong with me. I'm not going to eat you." As he spoke, he was aware of how it sounded. "I shouldn't have said that," he thought. Once he'd passed her, the woman, released from her terror, ran away at such a speed it was as if there were a demon chasing her. She made a strange noise as she ran. He watched her flee. His experiment had been inconclusive. He had learned nothing about why people avoided him. That evening, his face looked different in the mirror. He had a regular face with a bit of a beard, a prominent forehead, good strong lips. His jaw was a little pointy, his ears didn't stick out, and he had been told that he had nice eyes. His teeth were white. He had never smoked in his life. But after his encounter with the woman, something had changed. Something about his coloring and the general shape of his face had gone slightly awry. The next day, he asked his mates at work if there was anything different about him. They looked at him and weren't sure. There was something different, they said, but they couldn't put their finger on what it was. He became obsessed with the idea that something about him had changed, and that the people who avoided him were responsible for that change. He was not sure how. He went out of his way to avoid the gaze of others, afraid that when people saw him, they would take extraordinary pains to avoid him. He made sure not to encounter anyone in the street. When he saw people from far away, he would hide or turn his back to them and remain like that until they had passed. At work, his behavior became so odd that people began to think him unhinged in some way. Those who had known him for a long time found it hard to believe. But his constant ducking when anyone looked at him, his reluctance to meet people's eyes, his frequent scurrying out of the way in corridors, which at first seemed comic, soon gave him a reputation for evasion that, with time, became a source of suspicion. Folks were puzzled by the way he'd suddenly disappear when looked at, by how he made himself as invisible as possible during meetings. They didn't understand why he never attended the parties to which he was invited, or why he never lingered for a drink after work. Often, people would catch him in the men's room, scrutinizing himself in the mirror. Sometimes he could be seen contemplating his shadow. When he spoke to people, he always seemed to be hiding his face. Soon, people began remarking on how odd he looked, though no one had really got a good look at him for some time. He never appeared in photographs anymore. If anyone turned a camera on him, he rushed off. Then he began to avoid mirrors. He was sure that the more he feared what he looked like, the more he would become what he feared. But what was he to do about people crossing the street to avoid him? How was he to carry on with the stress of being avoided, the negation of being shunned? The anxiety crippled his daily journey home. When he got to his street with its double line of plane trees, fear would grip him, a fear of the eyes of others. He sometimes wished that he could become invisible so he wouldn't have to endure the shame of seeing people flee from him. Then one day, it occurred to him that if he wore a mask, he would be freed from these anxieties. It seemed an elegant solution. There was a stall that sold masks in the local market on Sunday mornings. He looked at many different masks. Most of them, too outlandish, he rejected out of hand. What he needed was a mask that was as much like a normal human face as possible. He bought 7 and tried them out at home. He took care to put them on before looking in the mirror. Of the masks, 5 seemed useful. He felt that the best way to choose the most normal-looking one would be to try it out in the office and on the walk home. At work, no one seemed to recognize him. He was stopped at the reception desk, but when he gave proof of his identity, he was allowed upstairs. His colleagues balked at his appearance. When he sat at his desk, they asked if it was him. When he replied that it was, they stared. Then they began to whisper. He was summoned to his boss's office. "What are you playing at?"
"Nothing, sir."
"Why are you wearing a mask?" "It's done out of consideration for others. My face troubles people, sir."
The boss studied him.
"You call this consideration?"
"Yes, sir. At least people know better who I am."
"Do they?"
"I think so. And what's more, I can let them look at me. I don't mind being looked at with the mask on."
"But it's frightening. How do we know it's you? If everyone came to work with a mask on, life would be impossible."
"Well, let's try it for a week, sir, and see."
Each day he wore a different mask. Each day the response was the same. The manager called him into his office. By the end of the week, the manager had had enough. "You might need to see someone," the manager suggested.
"Oh, it will all be resolved next week," he said.
"Either you see someone or we'll have to fire you."
"But why, sir?"
"You are scaring everyone. You make it hard for people to do their work."
"It will all be sorted out next week," he promised.
Every day that week, his walk home had confirmed the efficacy of the masks. On the first day, women who normally would have fled across the street when they saw him now only stared at him as he went past. On the second day, a woman began to cross but changed her mind and stayed on the same side of the street, perhaps out of curiosity. By the fifth day, none of them noticed him. This surprised him. He was certain that the masks made him look unnatural. Why were those who normally fled from him bothered by his face, but not by his mask? He took the question to the man who sold masks at the local market on Sunday mornings.
"You never told me what you were buying them for," the man said. As if to advertise the power of the masks he sold, the man wore a mask himself. On this day, he was in an Aztec mask that delighted the children as they went past. Many people stopped to buy his impressive disguises.
"Now that you've told me the problem, I believe I have the best mask for you. There is one condition, though."
"Well, what's that?"
"For the first week that you wear it, you must believe that the mask is your face."
"Is that all?"
"That's all. It's simple." The man took him to the back of the stall, where he stored the vast quantity of masks he had acquired from all over the world. The man asked him to shut his eyes. Then the man put a mask on him and told him not to look in the mirror for a while. The man refused to charge him.
"You did me a favor. Because of you, all these people stopped at my stall. They must have been drawn here by your face, eh?" the man said, laughing.
When he got home, he was curious, but he did not look in the mirror. By morning, the mask had fused with his face. He touched his cheek and felt no mask on it. He had no need to look in the mirror. At work, everyone stared at him in wonder. The manager called him into his office and gazed at him for a long time, and then sent him back to his desk without uttering a word. On the walk home, he was so preoccupied with the unusual reaction of his co-workers that he forgot to notice whether people crossed the road to avoid him. Near his house, a pretty young woman stopped him to ask for directions. She was lost. He gave her clear instructions and wished her well. At the end of the week, one of the women in the office, a beautiful woman with long legs and fierce lipstick, who worked in the digital department,
ask him what he was doing for lunch. But he didn't get the hint. He no longer noticed his own mask, but he began to see the masks of others. When he walked home in the evenings, he wondered why he had never noticed them before. Now that he did, he saw that it was necessary to avoid them, and he crossed the street before it was too late. Next, from the February 1st, 2021 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, This Week in Fiction, Ben Okri on Perception and Illusion. The author discusses A Wrinkle in the Realm, his story from this week's issue of the magazine, by Deborah Treisman. Your story in this week's issue, A Wrinkle in the Realm, revolves around a man who notices that women suddenly seem afraid of him and cross the street to avoid him. You don't mention that man's race, but the experience he describes is familiar to many black men in the U.S. and presumably in Britain and elsewhere too. Do you think of the story as one about racial identity or fear? Or the fascinating thing was to write a story about something without naming it, in such a way that the story speaks about it more strongly than if it had been named. I began with an experience that, over time, had become ground into the fabric of reality that is absorbed as a part of living. This is when it becomes most insidious. It eats into the psychic cavities. After a long time, I sought a way to write about it at a slight remove, so that the distortion that it wreaks on the soul would become more evident through the absurdity of the strategy my character develops for dealing with it. The story is also about perception, how we perceive the way we are perceived. Well, is there something speculative about the story? Why is it titled A Wrinkle in the Realm? Well, there's also a speculative aspect to the story, in the idea of taking an image and wandering off with it through the anguish of the human heart to where it intersects with humor. The story is called A Wrinkle in the Realm because in that universe where people respond irrationally to what they see, something has been glimpsed. The world is governed by perceptions that have a greater force than laws, but they are illusions. The wrinkle is the momentary revelation of that illusion. We are in such a time now. The disparity between the police responses to the Black Lives Matter march on Washington and to the pro-Trump attack on the Capitol is one such wrinkle. Well, the story describes, among other things, the psychological toll of living in a society that views you as different or threatening. It made me think, for obvious reasons, of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Was the story inspired by another work? Or by a specific experience? The story was inspired not by another work, but by life itself. But the difficulty was how to refract it in a new way. I wanted the story to have a neutral tone that would allow the action to get stranger and yet feel more normal. The inflections of Kafka, the thematic insinuations of Ellison, however, hover over the tale. But it is also written in the tradition of the old-fashioned Kunz, those stories in which strangeness blurs the real, like the late Tales of Melville, the brief notations of Hawthorne. Your protagonist takes comfort in hiding his face behind a mask. Was the story written during the coronavirus pandemic? Did our new regime of mask-wearing trigger the idea? The story was hijacked by history. Or it's probably truer to say that between the conception and the execution, history walked into the story. I'd been carrying the notion for years, and then I found a way to write it. And then the pandemic brought mask wearing. I kept my tranquility because the extreme nature of the masks in the story is hinted at in one or two details. A writer can only accept the accidental gifts of history. They are sort of grace notes. But it is strange when reality collaborates with your fiction. That happened to me in a more significant and disturbing way with my 2019 novel, A Freedom Artist. Events in the world made porous the boundaries between fiction and reality. At the end of the story, spoiler alert, the man puts on a mask that becomes his face. Should we read this metaphorically? Is the mask his real face? Has its reality disappeared? Great care was taken to keep that as open and ambiguous and as clear as possible. Perhaps the whole meaning of the tale is in that moment when the mask becomes his face. Perhaps there begins the discovery of the wrinkle in the realm. But then, please remember that I come from a tradition where the making of masks is a magical, shamanic, and highly spiritual enterprise. It connects the power of the ancestors, the world of spirits, the forces of the universe, and the deflecting of evil. How much of that has influenced the story is anyone's guess. The final mask may be the most real thing in the whole tale, more real than the perceptions of the world. And perhaps the man's reality has changed, become quietly transformed in some way. The need for invisibility has given way to the greater strength of having found a secret strategy for neutralizing the Medusa gaze of the world. We have a story collection, Prayer for the Living, coming out in the U.S. this month. Are those stories connected in any way to A Wrinkle in the Realm? Well, the stories in Prayer for Living are concerned with the political and spiritual implications of our grasp of what constitutes reality. They blur reality and dream. In the collection, there are 24 stories and one poem. Some of the stories are stokas, a form I made up in the aughts, which is an amalgam of the short story and the haiku. Others are long tales. Some are what you might call flash fiction. But all the stories, even the most political ones, are investigations into the nature of reality, which must be the most contested thing in all existence. Our sense of power, our ideologies, our politics, our loves, our fears are all bound up in it. Whether the stories involve famine, the violent deeds of Boko Haram, the impossible desire to get to Byzantium, or the warping of the world in a quantum thriller, they contest the idea that the nature of reality is ineluctable. A Wrinkle in the Realm takes this trope, this examination, to a twilight, fabular plane. Ben Okri won the 1991 Booker Prize for The Famished Road. Next, from the February 5th, 2021 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, the page-turner section. Can we control the voice in our head? A new book argues that our inner critic can become our strongest guide, by Katie Waldman. In The Voice in Your Head, a darkly comic short film by the writer-director Graham Parks, a man wakes up every morning to find a fit, hipsterish dope perched next to his bed. Good morning, F-word, the dope says. Ready for another disappointing day? The camera follows the pair from the shower. Your penis is very small, to the car. You know your dad hates you. And then to work, where the dope wearing a pinstriped olive jacket and gold chain keeps the bit going through lunchtime. Eat normal. He's a nuisance, a torment, and not especially original. The kind of bargain bin hater that makes all the rest of us critics look bad. This dope, or some form of him, is also the subject of Chatter, a new book by the experimental psychologist Ethan Cross. The book's subtitle, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters, and How to Harness It, reflects a slightly warmer attitude toward our inner cynic, who can also, Cross suggests, become our best coach. It's an irresistible thought experiment. What does yours look like? A drill sergeant? A languidly bored crush? Cross, who studies the science of introspection at the University of Michigan's Emotion and Self-Control Lab, which he founded, aims to produce a different sort of portrait, one pieced together from MRI scans and clinical observations. Chatter, which spends a lot of time examining high-drama conversations that go nowhere, arrives as hundreds of millions of people broadcast their innermost thoughts, or what they'd like us to believe are their innermost thoughts, on social media every day. But Cross argues that self-talk has long been a part of humanity's basic architecture. We are perpetually slipping away from the present into the parallel, non-linear world of our minds, he writes. Our default state is a rich zone of remembrance, musing, projection. This is a quiet rejoinder to New Age wisdom. People are simply not designed to live in the moment. And the first part of Chatter grounds its argument in research about the brain. Cross reports that mental descants are part of the phonological loop, the element of working memory that transcribes everything related to words that occurs around us in the present. In addition to an inner voice, there is also an inner ear. The loop guides our attention. The voice specifically evaluates us as we strive for goals, popping up to assess our progress, like an appointment reminder appearing on your lock screen. Using this voice, Cross writes, we can run mental simulations, rehearsing possible responses to a coworker's question or a partner's complaint. We can also construct meaningful narratives through autobiographical reasoning, telling ourselves stories, as Didion put it, in order to live. But, according to Cross, we just as often tell ourselves stories in order to be miserable. The inner voice, which is also an inward-turning voice, tends to linger over negative content. What's more, it can call our attention to processes that run more smoothly in the dark, deconstructing what should be seamless movement into a broken jumble of steps. By way of example, the book recounts in excruciating detail the mental block that ended the pitching career of Major League Baseball's Rick Ankiel. And Cross writes, even as our chatter makes a micromanager of the brain, it gobbles up valuable bandwidth, dragooning neurons into the dual task of listening to it and completing their jobs. Short-term performance isn't the only casualty. Cross posits that the inner voice, unsurprisingly, stokes our stress production, keeping our bodies in a state of emergency that can eventually take a toll on our health. Cross is at his most engrossing when discussing the similarities between talking to ourselves and talking to others. The two types of conversation engage much of the same mental circuitry. This is due, in part, to the principle of neural reuse, the brain's resourceful answer to size constraints imposed by the skull. The inner voice originates outside of us, with caretakers articulating values and beliefs, other early memories, and seeps in little by little. The functions of external and internal expression are intertwined, too. In the late 1980s, Cross writes, the Belgian psychologist Bernard Reim observed that just as the inner voice pipes up in moments of stress, people feel compelled to talk to each other when they're in extremis. Chatter wants to expand on this dynamic. The book offers a series of strategies for marshaling, inside our own heads, the power of an outside perspective. I began to read it almost as a guide to splitting oneself in two. The rhetorical device of Ilyism is the habit of referring to oneself in the third person. Julius Caesar was an early adopter. Ile means he in Latin. In Cross's hands, this vainglorious tactic becomes something else, a coping mechanism with a new label, distanced self-talk. High usage of first-personal singular pronouns is a reliable marker of negative emotion, Cross writes. Better to adopt the advantage of a neutral observer. Katie is scrambling to meet her deadline, not me. Cross also notes that the bell tone of our names can recenter us. The TV personality Mr. Rogers, for instance, pumped himself up to write new scripts with the command, "Get to it, Fred." Per Cross, experimental subjects who practice distant self-talk are more likely to reframe a threat as a challenge. Finally, Cross recommends temporal distancing, or imagining a future in which the agony lies behind you, See, the motto of Dan Savage's mental health campaign for queer teenagers, it gets better. If these tidbits don't sound particularly revelatory, chatter moves on to more exciting terrain when it considers the role that actual other people play in self-talk. Recall Bernard Ryman, the scientist who noted how we yearn to unburden ourselves to loved ones. Ryman also argued that as cross-rites, these conversations can cause harm, at least when conducted ad nauseum. Such a conclusion flies in the face of a robust tradition of thought. Beginning with Aristotle, an influential line of philosophers has proposed that strong feelings must out, that our griefs require purging through cathartic, often ritualized expression. In the 1890s, Freud employed the hydraulic model of emotion. Psychic energies build pressure and seek release like vapor from a tea kettle. With chatter, Cross stands athwart the tea kettle, yelling, "Stop!" Not only does endless venting constitute a social repellent, he argues, but it drives people to fruitlessly sustain the very feelings that hurt them in the first place. The book introduces, as sort of a tempter or villain, a lesser-known sibling to the fight-or-flight response, tend and befriend. When we suffer emotional pain, Cross claims, we often seek out empathy from others, and our intense desire to soothe the psychological effects of our problems derails our search for solutions. When our minds are bathed in chatter, Cross writes, we display a strong bias towards satisfying our emotional needs over our cognitive ones. This strikes me, somewhat painfully, like lightning, as an elegant and useful insight. By this point, though, the book's argument has come almost fully unstuck from the idea of a phonological loop. Chatter's back half, which features a parade of mind hacks, is tailored to readers who would combat their own negativity rather than to those who might be interested in what it means to possess an inner voice. One could wish for a differently ambitious work, but the recommendations seem helpful, if familiar. And bonus, the book offers a beautiful theory for why nature can prove so replenishing. The outdoors, Cross writes, brims with boughs, flowers, and animals that delicately lure and guide our attention. We don't have to concentrate in order to find ourselves lightly enthralled. And so our minds feel both refreshed and stimulated by these objects of soft fascination. At the risk of mangling the research, it occurs to me that certain books also promote soft fascination, and that chatter, with its friendly, crystal-clear tone, aims to be one of them. Popular science writing has developed an arsenal of clichés to achieve a frictionless reading experience. These gestures, which crop up in chatter, include section openings that begin with a date and a vivid anecdote. In June 2018, the Spanish tennis superstar Rafael Nadal stepped onto the clay courts of the French Open. Self-deprecation and a witty cross-section of examples, which attest not only to the suppleness of the theory, but also to the author's ability to think outside the box. Chatter, for instance, invokes King Solomon, LeBron James, and Malala. Cross is likable and practical on the page, and his self-help program seems less insidiously evil than most. That said, when Chatter defined awe as a brain state in which the neural activity associated with self-immersion decreases, I despaired. There's something deeply mysterious, even awesome, about our inner voice, the means by which we make ourselves aware of who we are and what we think. Cross has good ideas about how to manage and control this voice, and yet this book at times feels transactional where it could be curious. Reading it, I wondered not how to reconcile cognitive needs with emotional ones, but how my inner voice seemed to know what my emotional needs were before I did. After all, these strange narrators aren't just our employees. They are, on some core level, our companions, beloved precisely because science or even language cannot touch them. They talk our lives into being. When we send them away, Where do they go? Next, I'll read some flash fiction from the New Yorker magazine. From the July 25th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I Like Your Shoes by Kevin Brockmeyer. The note read, I like your shoes. She found it spelled out in the condensation on her living room window, written glidingly with a sort of throwaway prettiness, in strokes with the width of a fingertip. When she attempted to wipe it off, her palm came back dry. Even so, it took her a moment to understand the situation. The writing was, had to be, on the outside of the glass. Her apartment was on the 16th floor, with no balconies or even window ledges. How such a message could have gotten there, who could have composed it, eluded her. The heat of the morning took hold as the sun crested the high-rises, and she watched as, all at once, the words were inhaled back into the air. The second note arrived a few months later, I like your shoes, written in the same pleasingly rounded hand as before. She pressed her cheek to the window, searching for a suspended platform, a bungee cord, some scaffolding, or suction marks, but the face of the building offered only glass and aluminum. The third note appeared early the following winter, lingering in the frost above the kitchen sink as she washed the dishes. The familiar words, I like your shoes, almost escaped her notice, since the sky behind them was the same marmoreal gray as the ice. The fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh notes arrived on a hot April afternoon within the span of a few minutes, fading away and then replacing one another with a bellows-like breathing rhythm. I like your shoes. I like your shoes. I like your shoes. I like your shoes. By then, she had moved to a third-floor walk-up in a converted school building. Her new boyfriend, obliged by his commute to wake an hour earlier than she did, often left little goodbyes for her on the kitchen counter or on the dry erase board. But his grabbed script was nothing like the declarations that had pursued her across the city, so fluidly, so puckishly made. She was certain they were not from him. What she was starting to suspect was that the notes would accompany her for the rest of her life, that some god, ghost, or demon would go on until the day she died, liking her shoes. And even after 11 different houses and apartments, hundreds of guest rooms and hotel suites, 7 boyfriends, 2 husbands, and several checkerboards worth of windows, she would never be sure whether the message was meant to be a compliment or an insult. The phrase reminded her of the roundabout observations of teenage girls, the kind who put just enough sugar on their barbs to disguise them as flattery. Every time she went shoe shopping, she found herself asking the same question. But what do they really think? And now, flash fiction from the September 6, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Break, by Rabib Almedin. A few years after the break, I received an envelope from Beirut from my brother, Mazen, containing nothing but a black and white photograph. Standing before the cadre of mailboxes in the dark lobby of my building, I tore open the envelope and tried to figure out why Mazen would send me a picture of himself and his bride. No note, not one word, just a cliché of a wedding portrait, the couple coming out of the church, a young Mazen, plump and fleshy, beginning to follow in his father's footsteps, dark suit and tie, a beaming smile on his face, grains of rice stuck to his meticulously gelled hair. Clearly besotted, he was gazing at his bride, while she, coiffed hair streaked with highlights and gardenias, looked seductively at the camera, her leer proclaiming, I'll give him the wedding night, and then all bets are off. Had we been speaking, I would have warned poor Mazen. They divorced after 10 hellish years. At the time, I didn't understand what he was trying to do. If he wanted to make contact, why send me a picture? Why not a letter? A phone call? Did he think this inanity would make me forgive him his duplicity? He was my closest friend always, my only friend. Co-signers of a covenant, we shared a bed till he was 10, pressed together against the same sheets of cotton, and he abandoned me. I sent my reply, a photograph of my girlfriend and me. She and I were young and in lesbian love, and the picture reflected it. We were atop each other in Central Park, haloed by glorious sunlight and a furious cloud of gnats. I sported big hair and layers of early Madonna tops over my budding breasts. 10 years earlier, I had won a scholarship to Yale, a full eating, drinking, sleeping, studying scholarship, the prestige of which had earned me my family's blessing. Leave, leave, young man, God be with you. Leave and return to us with untold riches and a smidgen of culture to edify. I left Lebanon, and I transitioned in college, changing from a depressed young man to an angry one. The humiliations of my childhood, the don't do this, the boys don't do that, the you must try to be normal, all those sticks and twigs, dry kindling, burst into furious bonfire. Everything was my family's fault, of course it was. My cracked cup runneth over with molten rage that no saucer would contain. My calls home became more obstreperous and less frequent. My side of the conversations consisted of various permutations of, I hate you, I loathe you, you never respected me, you never understood me, I'm unhappy and you made me so, I demand justice, I despise you. Anger was the shape of my breath. Outrage the sound of my voice. I cultivated indignation like a hothouse flower. My mother made sure to explain that I was giving the whole family a bad name, that they would be mocked and ridiculed because of me and the way I was choosing to live my life. I don't know which was the final straw, changing my major or changing my sex. I switched from pre-med to English at the beginning of my second year. I went out in public with coal on my eyes and ruby red lipstick in the middle of my third. My mother decided that I was dead. No one was to talk to or of me, not my father, not my siblings. She killed me. Nothing hurt as much as being cut off from Mazen. When, as a child, I used to wake up terrified in the dark, so scared that I would sidle closer to him in our small bed and hug him fiercely. He poured comfort into my ears. The nightmare was not real, he would tell me. It couldn't hurt me. I was certain that I'd never forgive his betrayal. But he sneaked back into my life, slipped into the water with a silent paddle. We sent photographs back and forth for 7 years, but no words were exchanged. Our relationship was reduced to visual correspondence. It was only later, when he came to visit for the first time, that I learned that he'd sworn to the homunculus that was his mother that he would chop off his tongue if he uttered a word to me, that he'd saw off a finger if he wrote a single letter to the family freak. Instead, he'd send me a picture of himself on a Beirut beach, and I'd return one of my wife and me in matching skirts. I received a snapshot of his son and returned one of my cats. I refused to break. I immured my heart in iron. I was the strong one. When I published my first book, I didn't think anyone back in my cursed home country would even notice. Small press, different name, poetry. How Mazen found it, I do not know. I received a picture of him with his second baby boy cradled in his right arm and his left hand holding Epistles, My Pride in Paperback, the title stationed right where his heart was supposed to be. He broke first. I received a 4x6 portrait of his son with a slightly bleeding nose, taken hastily, badly lit, likely by a bathroom bulb. On the 10-year-old face, a thread of blood trickled from nose to upper lip, curving an OG around the corner of the mouth and down the chin. The boy was in no pain. He looked inquisitively at the camera, probably wondering why his father had the urge to bring it out. I held my breath for a beat or two, or three, when I saw the image. On the back of the photograph, Mazen had written, I keep seeing you. Iron is iron until it is rust. When I was 10, a bully at school pushed me into a wall. My nose bled. Mazen, 11 at the time, took me to the lavatory and helped me clean my face. We missed two classes, hiding and holding each other in the bathroom. The boy's face in the photograph is an almost exact replica of the one I saw in the mirror that day. Mazen's son looks more like me than like his father. My response didn't include a picture. Like him, I began with only one sentence, the incipit of all further conversation. In the middle of a white sheet, I wrote, "I have never stopped missing you." And now, from the February 8, 2021 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the Culture Desk, Super Bowl music, The Weeknd's self-loathing Springsteen's Jeep, and Dolly Parton's gig economy. Nearly every major cultural event arrives with an asterisk these days, some pandemic-related compromise that distinguishes it from past occurrences. As absurd as these spectacles often feel, why would you have an award show in the middle of a pandemic? No, seriously, I'm asking, Jimmy Kimmel joked during his opening monologue at last year's remote Emmy telecast. I suppose insisting on certain traditions can still be seen as an act of hope, or at least a desperate attempt to cling to normalcy. The main asterisk at this year's Super Bowl was the size of the live audience. The Raymond James Stadium in Tampa was only one-third full. 7,500 of those 25,000 occupied seats were reserved for vaccinated healthcare workers who attended as guests of the league. 30,000 of the remaining seats were occupied by cardboard cutouts, which the NFL sold in advance for $100 a pop. The halftime show featured just a single artist, Abel Tesfaye, who performs as The Weeknd, and no additional guests. Tesfaye, who is 30, was born in Toronto to Ethiopian immigrants and has sold more than 75 million records since he began self-releasing mixtapes a decade ago. He has always been somewhat inscrutable to the public. His first singles were posted online anonymously. He quickly took to obscuring his face in photographs, and he still doesn't confess much in interviews, on the rare occasion that he consents to one. Since last January, when Tesfaye debuted the video for Blinding Lights, a throbbing, luminous single from After Hours, his fourth record, he has been appearing as the character, a bloodied, bruised, sometimes elaborately bandaged figure in a red sports coat and black leather gloves. Tesfaye recently told Variety that the character is a commentary on vapidity, hedonism, and pride. Quote, "The significance of the entire head bandages is reflecting on the absurd culture of Hollywood celebrity and people manipulating themselves for superficial reasons to please and be validated," he said. Tesfaye is often compared to Michael Jackson, but where Jackson was sentimental, Tesfaye is resolutely cynical and self-loathing. His aesthetic is lewd, dark, drug-obsessed, and obscure. All of that made him an especially interesting choice for the 2021 Pepsi Super Bowl halftime show. A furtive nihilist prone to oblivion who comfortably sings lyrics such as, "But if I OD, I want you to OD right beside me." The halftime show is usually exultant, swaggering, goofy. It was hard to imagine how The Weeknd's brooding 80s-inspired R&B, which nods to Duran Duran and Flock of Seagulls, with just a touch of the Smiths' boundless melancholy and echoes of Prince's sly coyness, might translate to such a broad stage. Tesfaye's two favorite lyrical tropes are unfeeling sex and drug abuse. "I only love it when you touch me, not feel me. When I'm effed up, that's the real me," he sings on the hills. Tesfaye's performance was subdued, at least by the Super Bowl's generally psychotic standards. It was set in a Vegas-y cityscape, with Tesfaye backed by a sizable robot choir turned human choir turned string section. He wore the red blazer, sequined to this time, and the leather gloves, but his face was fully visible, unmarred by fake blood or gauze. He was, however, joined at various points by a small army of fully bandaged and blazered dancers, first in a mirrored, neon-lit hallway of sorts, and then directly on the field for blinding lights, which closed his eight-song medley. The bandages, the lyrics, the lighting, it all felt very macabre, which itself felt apropos. Even the weekend's most beloved hits are about finding solace in annihilation. I can't feed my face when I'm with you, but I love it, he admits. He's not a dancer, exactly, but he moved through the stands and across the field with elegance. In a small but meaningful gesture to longtime fans, Tesfaye briefly incorporated a bit of House of Balloons, Glass Table Girls, which samples Happy House by Susie and the Banshees, and which appeared on the weekend's first mixtape from 2011. When fireworks exploded above Tampa at the end of his show, in a resolute display of cheerfulness, I couldn't help but laugh. Performing at halftime usually means losing money. Tesfaye supposedly sunk $7 million from his own fortune into the show, and getting relentlessly clowned on Twitter, regardless of what you do. For me, most of Tesfaye's choices were expert and felt true to the motifs of his music, which I also found to be a relief. It did not seem like the right year for another Left Shark. Beyond the halftime show, music was still a significant part of the evening. Two commercials incited chatter and consternation before they aired. The middle, an advertisement for Jeep, starring Bruce Springsteen, occupied an entire two-minute commercial break. Springsteen does not endorse products, and the spot was filmed just a week ago, which perhaps suggests some zero-hour equivocation on his part. This is the triumph of perseverance and stubbornness. Olivier Francois, the chief marketing officer of Stellantis, the multinational automotive company that owns Jeep, recently told Variety. He had been pitching Springsteen's manager John Landau for a decade with little success. Bruce is not for sale. He's not even for rent, Francois said. Springsteen composed the soft droning score with the producer Rob Aniello. Many of Springsteen's own songs are explicitly about cars, but of course he has also enthusiastically called them suicide machines. The commercial is thoughtfully shot and mercifully low on glamour shots of Jeeps. Springsteen circles the center chapel, adorned with a cross. It's not quite ideologically neutral territory, near Lebanon, Kansas, at the precise geographic center of the contiguous United States. Lebanon has souvenirs, a wooden sign notes. The metaphorical significance of the location is not subtle, and neither is the commercial's deployment of well-worn patriotic iconography, a roadside diner, a thermos of hot coffee on a wintry eve, flags, more crosses, a horse, an empty stretch of two-lane highway. Springsteen meditatively letting a pinch of American dirt slip through his fingers. Springsteen did not write the commercial script, but its particular cadences do suit his voice and recall his recent forays into professional storytelling. All are more than welcome to come meet here in the middle, he narrates. It's no secret the middle has been a hard place to get to lately, between red and blue, between servant and citizen, between our freedom and our fear. The commercial's message is reconciliation. Consider forgiveness, Springsteen implores. Right, you might be saying to yourself, okay, but what about just 32 days ago when a mob of insurrectionists supported by elected Republicans invaded and debased the Capitol while threatening to execute the vice president and others? Whether or not the Jeep commercial inflates your sense of national unity will likely have something to do with whether or not you fully metabolize that event and have somehow, bless you, already arrived at a place of magnanimity and healing. There is, at least, something exquisitely and singularly American about a message of political unity being delivered by a rich and cloistered celebrity who has long been positioned as an everyman savior, while he is simultaneously selling cars, partway through a football game, being held before a not insignificant crowd in the midst of a global pandemic. Meanwhile, Dolly Parton, another hugely beloved musical icon, recorded a new version of her hit 9 to 5 for the web hosting company Squarespace. Much like The Middle, The commercial caused many to wonder what exactly our heroes are commanding us to do and why we should listen to them. Parton opted to rewrite the chorus to refer to an all-nighter. Working 5 to 9, you've got passion and a vision, because it's hustling time, only way to make a living, she sings. It seems as if the spot is supposed to convey the hopeful idea that we are not contained or limited by our soul-crushing day jobs. But what it actually suggests is that we should be defined and occupied exclusively by work for 24 crippling hours a day. That the original 9-to-5 is a protest anthem of sorts, decrying the more dehumanizing aspects of capitalism, barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never really give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it, Parton sings in that version. Makes the new iteration feel especially grievous. It perhaps doesn't help that partisan disagreement over universal basic income and the raising of the minimum wage are at least part of what sent Springsteen off to stare glumly at snowbanks in Kansas. The New Statesman has called the commercial an uber-capitalist girl boss hellscape. Can it ever not be hustling time and exhausted quarantined with no child care taking Zoom calls from the bathroom nation wondered? Ultimately, the weekend's music, rhythmic, dance-oriented, and often beautiful, but so plainly despondent at heart, felt like the night's most appropriate mirror of our cultural moment. As incongruous as Tesfaye's apocalyptic vibe might have been in the midst of a massive recreational sporting event, it also felt like an honest response to where we are now. His songs are about coping by any means necessary. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New York readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.